So my buddy Tim bought a jet ski.
Mm-hmm. Oh, dude, I was just talking about buying jet skis the other day. Because both of my buddies have boats, and I'm like, I'm not buying a boat. I'm going to buy 2, 3, 4 jet skis and just, yeah.
I'll be honest with you, we have kind of always said that if we ever made it big, we'd buy jet skis.
Yeah.
And we have almost made it big.
So we're almost going to buy jet skis.
So.
Yeah.
Anyway, really excited about it. Every year, my sister-in-law, so Natalie's sister's husband's father.
Okay.
So my brother-in-law's father-in-law. No, my brother-in-law's father.
On the other, yep, okay.
Goes out for Father's Day on his boat. And we go out on the lake.
Dude, take the jet ski.
So no, here's what I'm thinking. It's like a Father's Day thing, right? But it's like neither of the people I'm out there with are really like my dad. It's my father-in-law and it's my sister-in-law's father-in-law.
Okay.
So I'm thinking Tim kind of comes and rescues me from it, right? He drives out the 2.5 miles, and then I'm like, sorry, everybody. I like throw my backpack like as a spy wheel. I'm like, sorry, everybody. It's time to hang out for Father's Day with my daddy. Jump on the back,
oh, wow.
Wrap my arms around him, and then he drives me away.
And you're just done then?
That's how I imagine that scene.
You're just done then?
Awesome.
Are you coming back? Are you coming
back? I'm honestly considering like actually doing this like as a joke.
Are you going to tell your own wife?
Maybe coming back. No.
Is she going to be on that boat?
I think, yeah.
You're just going to abandon ship.
So funny. How funny would it be if, like,
because how far are you going to go, though? Because here's the thing. It's like, I'm just picturing this open lake. You have to get out of, like, sight to land the joke. You just have to go on that jet ski for, like, a while. So you can, like, dip behind an island to disappear in the sunset.
His jet ski goes, like, 65 miles an hour.
That's awesome.
Maxed out. I don't think we're going to max it out, but, like, I think it would be a really funny joke.
Cool. He's got to find you on the lake. You got
to
like.
Yeah, but we go to like a point that's like
okay.
A well-known point.
That'd be, yeah, I mean.
It'd be hilarious. All right. Anyway,
luck.
Welcome to the Back to Basics podcast. This is a podcast where me and my brother, we're both medical providers. I'm a nurse paramedic. He is a ER physician. We take complicated medical topics and we break them down to basics.
Or at least we try to.
Yes. Sometimes we go on tangents about.
Jet skis
or dogs last time, orca whales.
You know what?
A lot of strange things. So we're going to try to keep it nice and tight in this one and just get through it. We're going to try to keep it to a half hour. But this is a two-parter. So what we're going to do is we're going to cover ACLS. We'll talk about what that is and how it all works. But we're going to cover ACLS, the general topics of ACLS, in a part one lecture and a part two lecture. So you should listen to these back-to-back, and then you'll get 2 half credits for it. We're going to try to keep them to half hours. But that's a challenge because there's a lot to cover, and a typical ACLS course is multiple days. However, let's talk about what ACLS is. ACLS is Advanced Cardiac Life Support. It is the most popular ACLS is given by the American Heart Association.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a licensure that you can get. And it's kind of a staple in the, you know, medical community, I would say, in terms of like getting some advanced training. And it basically, when it comes down to it, covers 6 emergencies. And these are emergencies that you can experience in the field as like an EMS provider, or emergencies that you could experience anywhere in the hospital too, right? So you'll usually have like critical care teams or rapid response teams that will respond to things like codes on your floor. They would all need to be ACLS certified typically. So if you want to be involved in that, you may need to be ACLS certified as well. So ACLS, Advanced Cardiac Life Support, covers 6 cardiac emergencies, technically 5 cardiac emergencies and 1 neurological emergency.
Sure.
So it covers your heart has stopped, so you're dead, cardiac arrest. Your heart has restarted after dying, ROSC, return of spontaneous circulation. Your heart is going too fast, tachycardia. Your heart is going too slow, bradycardia. Your heart is having a heart attack, acute coronary syndromes. And your brain is having an attack, similar to a heart attack, you're having a stroke. That is the gist of what ACLS is. Mm-hmm. And it basically applies algorithms, which are just fancy way of saying a nice systematic step process to how to treat and handle these emergencies and identify them. Chris and I are both ACLS instructors. We have been for years. I personally have taught ACLS just under 1,000 times.
Really?
Yeah.
You counted that
one time?
Wow.
It's crazy.
That's nuts.
So a lot of ACLS.
Yeah.
We are not – some of the things that we're not going to do, we're not going to do like – we'll give you kind of general guidelines on how the treatment works. We're not going to give you any dosages or anything that's like AHA-specific or Red Cross-specific or anything like that. Those can change, so do your own research. This isn't going to count as your licensure for ACLS, so definitely attend the classes, but hopefully this will give you a good idea of kind of what you'd be getting into and learning in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough? Because I know what's going to happen is people are going to be like, that's the 2018 guidelines, blah, 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 blah. We're going to talk about general treatments. These treatments don't really change.
Right.
Okay. Today what we're doing in part one.
Part one, we're going to do cardiac arrest and return of spontaneous circulation. Yes. These are the most fun ones. I don't know. I like cardiac arrest and ROSC, and here's why. I like that we have created ROSC as its own emergency. Like, I think for so long, and a lot of times people still do this, they look at cardiac arrest as both the cardiac arrest component and when we get somebody back. And what I like about separating those two is that, like, what we do, I like splitting them up because there's such important aspects of how we treat cardiac arrest. And there are some very specific ways in how we treat return of spontaneous circulation that they need to be separated because we lose emphasis on what we do after we've gotten pulses back a lot of times. And that can be such a critical component to someone's morbidity, mortality in the long run, all that kind of stuff. The goal is not necessarily to get someone's heart beating and then you're done. Like, the goal is to get someone's heart beating and have them go from there to be able to, like, have quality of life again.
Right.
And there's a lot of key components that have to play in acutely when that happens. And you got to do it right if you really want to get to those endpoints.
Yeah. Kendra, our sister, just sent me an article last night, actually, that was like, hey, is this too negative? And it was basically an article about, like, outcomes of CPR and how negative they can be sometimes. And I was like, no, not really. But here are some, like, factors, you know, but, like, people don't realize that, like, you don't do it right. You know what I mean? If you're not doing ROSC right, quality of life is going to drop quite a bit there, right? This also isn't BLS, all right? So we've done a lot about a lot of courses and credits and things like that on BLS, on how that works, on how CPR works, on how NAED works. We're going to kind of very quickly cover that so that we can jump into the advanced component of that and now how, you know, static and dynamic EKG rhythms work and sort of some of that stuff.
But I would say that does, like, what we cover today is less important than those things when it comes to cardiac arrest and ROSC,
right?
High quality CPR, good quality chest compressions, all that stuff is way more important than the stuff we're going to cover today.
Right.
So I think a lot of times it's easy. We see advanced cardiac life center instead of basic. I think it's more important, definitely not more important.
Right. So yeah, ACLS is built off of good BLS and it's useless without it. Mm-hmm. So just want to be clear on that. You can check out our other lectures. You can check out our other podcasts that cover more BLS topics. We would encourage you to do that, but we're doing ACLS today. All right. So real quick, what is cardiac arrest? Cardiac arrest is when your heart stops and you're dead. All right. When your heart stops, you are defined legally and clinically as dead, right? You may be revivable, but you are dead. People, I think, tend to think that cardiac arrest is like a special way to die. No, you always die from cardiac arrest, right?
The end point to life is your heart stopping.
Is your heart stopping in cardiac arrest. So when people say, like, he died from cardiac arrest, as opposed to, like, that guy died from trauma, it's like, no, that guy died from cardiac arrest too.
Due to trauma.
Yeah, due to trauma, right? So cardiac arrest is just the stopping of the heart.
It's worth making that point because I think we do this when we teach our basic classes and stuff, but, like, the person can't get worse. So everything you do from here is critically important and you don't need to shy away or be fearful, I think, of some of the aspects of cardiac arrest care because, again, you can't really make the situation worse.
Yeah, this
you cannot. You cannot make it better. Like, you could do this not well, and there, you know. But, like, even the save rates for people who have gone into cardiac arrest when we do utilize basic life support and advanced cardiac life support techniques is very low.
So it takes the pressure off.
Yeah,
you're not getting any deader. Do the best you can.
Yep.
Don't do anything that would be extra harmful. You know what I mean? Don't, like, also cut off their limb. But, you know, everything that we're going to be doing is going to be in an attempt to help, and you're protected in that too. We talk in our BLS stuff about Good Samaritan laws and stuff like that. Again, this is different. We're not talking about CPR today. We're talking about CPR as a component of advanced cardiac life support. So this is medical provider treatment. We're giving drugs. We're doing things like intubation. We're doing advanced airways. We're doing capnography. There's a lot of components to this. So let's start with recognizing cardiac arrest and then what we do, and then we'll kind of just really quickly cover, and I have this a little bit out of order on our notes, Chris, so I apologize, but we'll cover, like, AED usage and what it does, and then we'll shift back to, like, okay, EKG interpretation. That work for you?
Cool.
That's how good. I would typically do it. So how do we recognize that someone is dead?
They don't have a pulse.
They don't have a pulse, right? And this would be a palpable pulse. So we're going to try to feel their pulse in their neck. We always go for the neck because it's closest to the heart, and that's where we're most likely to feel the pulse. If they don't have a pulse, the only treatment that we're going to do is begin CPR.
I will say, I'll put a couple caveats here already. One, if you have someone hooked up to an EKG and you see some type of rhythm, that's not...
Doesn't mean that they have a pulse.
Doesn't mean they have a pulse. If you hook somebody up to a pulse oximeter even, and they have oxygen readings, but you don't feel a pulse, they don't have a pulse. The only thing, though, that is a better indication... Okay, I'll throw another one in there. Ultrasound. You put an ultrasound on someone's heart. You see cardiac activity. You see the heart beating, pumping. If they don't have a pulse, they don't have a pulse. The only thing outside of feeling for a pulse and not feeling it that can define cardiac arrest is capnography. Yes. And we did a whole podcast and credit on capnography. Take a look at that. Other than that, if you don't have capnography, you put your finger on their carotid. If you don't feel it, they need CPR. They need cardiac arrest care. Like, I think we have so many of these other techniques to look at other different aspects. Don't lose sight of the fact that when we look at the data and the research today, the best way to figure out if you're someone's in cardiac arrest is capnography. And if you don't have capnography, do you feel a pulse? And if you don't feel a pulse, you start CPR.
Right. So we've confirmed that they don't have a pulse. We're going to go ahead and start compressions. What compressions do, and we talked about this before, is we are basically shoving the rib cage down onto the heart muscle in order to squeeze it, in order to build up pressure in the heart. I used an analogy that was kind of crazy in our BLS thing, and I think I compared it to a sponge, or I said it's not like a sponge, and then that TikTok got over a million views of people just basically saying this is a terrible analogy. And you know what?
But we so got the million views.
Yeah, so I'm going to try to use more bad analogies in order to try to increase our virality.
Okay.
So what basically you're doing is you're building up a pressure in the heart so that the blood can start to move through your vessels because they're all connected. It's a pump. You're building up a pressure, and then you're moving and circulating that blood. Then hopefully the heart itself can perfuse. It can get enough oxygen to start beating on its own again, okay? That is the mechanical part of the beating heart. The electrical part of the beating heart is that you can have certain rhythms that will not cause the heart to beat. For instance, if I have a rhythm that is beating at 300 times per minute, the heart can't actually beat that fast, right? It can't fill up in that. So if my rhythm is – the electricity going through the heart is 300 times a minute, the heart won't be beating. I won't have a pulse, but there's still electrical activity in there. So just because you're dead and your heart's not beating doesn't mean that there's not an electrical rhythm moving through that heart. So that's where the EKG interpretation kind of comes into it, and that's where the use of an AED can come into it. So there are two shockable rhythms. One is called ventricular fibrillation, and one is called ventricular tachycardia, pulseless, that we will shock with an AED. And what the AED does is it resets electrical activity and stops your heart so that with good CPR, we can restart it and get another cleaner rhythm, all right? That's the simplest way I can put it. Now we're going to jump into a little bit more about like how EKGs work. Is that fair? Any questions or any things you would add to that?
Sounds great.
Okay. So normal structure and function of the heart. You have your atria are your upper chambers of your heart, and your ventricles are your lower chambers of your heart. And Jamie, I think what we're going to need to do is put up a picture of a heart at some point on this. I'll walk you through it. All right. So we're going to have a picture of a heart pop up. You have an SA node that's located in the upper left portion of your heart. It's in the upper chambers. Was your left in the picture?
Yes. So, your left in the picture, so but you're right in your body.
But you're right in your body.
The right atria.
Yep. In the right atria, you have this little node there, and it's this cluster of electrical cells that is the pacemaker for your heart. So that is the structure that is responsible for starting the electricity to travel down this pathway that you'll see a picture of now. And it's going to travel down this pathway. It's going to go through the junction of the heart where the ventricles and the atria meet, and then it's going to split off into two paths called the bundle branches.
Oh, sorry.
And then, the bundle and branches that are connected to the Purkinje fibers that will stimulate the lower portion of the heart down here. So the process is basically it moves down and kind of it almost moves like a fish hook does. And it goes down and then it splits off into those things. Then it comes back up to stimulate the ventricles. Now, I want you to imagine that there are a set of eyes at the lower right portion of this picture. So looking at the lower left portion of an actual heart. The eyes are here. They're going to pop up. Now that I have this technology, I'm going
to
use it all
the time. Someone listening to this podcast, though,
that's fine.
Is going
to
be...
But if they're getting a credit, they're watching it. So okay, this is point. How we got to work it out. All right. So So you're basically looking at the heart from the lower right corner of this picture of the heart. We're looking up at the electricity. What an EKG does is we put a lead down there and it reads electricity heading towards that set of eyes or towards the sticker that we put on their skin. So normally an EKG, when you have the SA node fire and electricity goes through the atria and gets to about where the bundle branches are, whenever electricity moves towards that lead, we have an upward deflection on the EKG. And that's going to be the form of a P wave. Okay. We call this first little bump on an EKG a P wave. Positive deflection because it's headed towards that set of eyes.
And that's the electrical activity moving from the top, from the SA node through the atria towards those eyes that are looking up at it.
Yes. So when we say that someone has a positive P wave, we can assume that their atria are depolarizing. This does not mean that someone has a pulse because remember, you can have an electrical rhythm moving through your heart but still be dead. Okay. There are dead bodies out there right now. That's kind of a weird, sure, right now, right? Like in an emergency, if Chris went down right now, there is a chance that he has the same heart rhythm that I have in my heart, but he's dead on the ground and doesn't have a pulse because that rhythm isn't generating enough electricity to get the heart to pump at that rate and rhythm. Mm-hmm. Got it? Okay, so that's the P wave. That's the first little portion. That represents the atria. Then, as you know, it splits into these two bundle branches and it's moving now towards those set of eyes. So we still have a little bit of a positive deflection, and then that's a first half of what we call the QRS wave. All right, and that's going to look like this. Then, as you can see, we curl up the sides of the ventricles, and now it's moving away from that set of eyes or away from that camera view or sticker. So now he's going to read the electricity is moving away from him, so he's going to scribble down, and that gives us the second half of the QRS wave. So we have a P wave and we have a QRS wave. The P wave represents the atria depolarizing. The QRS wave represents the ventricles depolarizing. Now, what we really care about in medicine is the ventricles depolarizing because that has the most amount of blood in it. So whenever the ventricles depolarize, that's when the heart well and truly beats, right?
Which is why someone who has atrial fibrillation, where the top of their heart's just kind of shaking, not pumping, is pumping blood fine and can have a pulse and just sit in that rhythm. Because the ventricles, like blood is getting to the ventricles. The ventricles are then pushing that out to the body.
Right. Now on an EKG, we have a third little bump on there called the T wave. It's a larger bump. And that is the repolarization or resetting of the ventricles. And because the ventricles largely are repolarizing from top to bottom, it's a big positive deflection. And the reason that we don't see the repolarization of the atria is because that would be happening during the QRS wave that we saw previously. So this little guy in the corner that's viewing the heart, this EKG, is only reading electrical activity. It doesn't matter if it's repolarization or depolarization. He doesn't care if it's positive or resetting, you know, negative energy. He's just going to read it and scribble on there. That's the gist of what a normal EKG should look like. You have a P wave, a QRS wave, and a T wave, which is the repolarization. And then depending on how we look at those scribbles, the rate of those scribbles, the rhythm of those scribbles, the changes in morphology is how we determine a lot of cardiac conditions. Now, some of these are going to be more important when we talk about tachycardia and bradycardia because it's going to be the rate of the QRSs, but we'll get to that. So what happens if that SA node, that pacemaker, fails? What's exciting about the heart is that any cell, any cardiac cell, electrical cell in the heart can actually take over as the pacemaker. So if my SA node fails, typically my AV node will take over. If my AV node fails, I can have any cell in the heart, it could be in the atria, it could be in the junction in that middle area, or it could be in the ventricles, take over as the active pacemaker. But that's going to change the direction that the electricity is moving because it has a new origin point. So how that little guy or that EKG views the heart's electricity is going to be different. And essentially, there are three neighborhoods that a cell can be coming from to generate that electrical activity. It could be in the atria, in which case we see a nice positive P wave like normal, and we have a nice positive and negative QRS in the T wave. It could be in the junction, which could actually reverse the polarity of the P wave. So the P wave might be opposite. I shouldn't say polarity. That's not a very good description.
So basically, the direction of the wave. If the cell that's triggering the pacemaker now is down in the junction, then when it depolarizes the atria, that electricity has to go up instead of down. So it's coming from the SA node, it's going down. If it's coming from the junction, it's going up. So if it's going up, then the eyes see it going away from it. So it's going to cause an inverted P wave.
Right. Or it might not have any P wave at all if the
somewhere in the middle
stimulating the ventricles is beating out the electricity that's stimulating the atria. Sure. So you could have a negative P wave, or a pause, or I'm sorry, or no P wave at all in a junctional rhythm. And then there could be ventricular rhythms where we have an automatistic beat that's starting in the ventricles. If that's the case, we're going to be on one side of the heart or the other. So no longer are we above those bundle branches where we can split off into two bifurcating ways, right? So it's going to take a longer period of time to jump onto this highway and then head backwards back to the junction and then go all the way to the other side of the heart. And that time on an EKG graph is represented from left to right. So ventricular rhythms always have very large QRS complex, big wide QRS complexes that look like this. So that's the gist of what EKG should look like. Half of reading EKGs are just trying to figure out how fast something's going and what neighborhood the electricity originates in. And we'll talk about why it matters in just a second. But first, how do we read an EKG? Step one, we look at the rate of the EKG. How do we do that?
You're counting the squares.
Count the squares, right?
So right. From left to right is time. So how many beats are happening in a period of time?
Right, and we already talked that beats typically are the QRS complexes because that's when the ventricles are beating. Again, this is in a patient with a pulse. So we would count all of the QRSs in a six-second strip, and we could multiply that by 10, and that would tell us our heart rate. What's another way to get heart rate? Feel their pulse rate and count, right? But read that on the EKG. That's how we would do that. There are some other ways to do it, but the street cheat, easy way to do it is look at a six-second strip, count the QRSs, multiply that by 10. Then we're going to look at the overall rhythm. Is it regular or is it irregular? The best way to look at this is look at your R waves, the top of the QRS, to the top of the next QRS, and then look at the next one. And if those spaces are even throughout, then we know that it's a nice regular rhythm, right? Then we look at P waves because we want to try to figure out what neighborhood this pacemaker is existing in, right? If we have a positive P wave, then we know that it's in the atria or it's the SA node itself. If we have a negative P wave, then we know it's in the junction. If we don't have a P wave, it could either be in the junction or the ventricles. Then we look at the QRS waves. Now we want to know if it has a narrow QRS, then I know that that's a junctional rhythm with no P wave, right? Or if it has a wide QRS, I know it's a ventricular rhythm. And then lastly, we look at the ST segment because we'll talk about this more when we talk about ACS, but we look for ST elevation or depression, which can be a sign of a heart attack. And that's how we read an EKG, those five steps.
Love it.
Fair enough. I know That's a lot of like textbook information. Hopefully we'll get some images up there to kind of help walk you through that. But that's sort of how we read an EKG. In cardiac arrest, what happens is the heart has stopped, but there could still be electrical rhythm within the heart, right? So our options essentially are there is no electrical rhythm, which means we have a flat line in the EKG, or there is electrical rhythm and it's normal, which would be any type of electrical rhythm you can think of besides VFib and VTach. So for instance, normal sinus rhythm, the same heart rate that I have right now, heart rhythm and rate, it's exactly the same, but the heart is dead. There are certain caveats that we need to make sure that we wouldn't want to shock that rhythm because shocking is resetting. I'm happy with what that rhythm is. I'm not happy that the heart isn't beating at that rhythm and rate. So in this case, that patient would just get the CPR and some other things, but we wouldn't shock that rhythm at all.
And so we call that pulseless electrical activity. So it's electrical activity that's like an organized regular activity, but there's no pulse. So pulseless electrical activity or PEA.
Right. In a flat line or asystole, we wouldn't shock that either. And because if we shocked a flat line, we would put someone into a flat line. It wouldn't do anything. We'd stop the heart. We're stopping nothing. And there's no point in doing that. So we don't shock a flat line either. So we don't shock PEA and we don't shock asystole or a flat line. What we do shock is called VFib. We're going to have it printed up on the screen right now. It is basically a very fast and irregular ventricular rate. It looks like a bunch of nonsense on the EKG. If we see something like this, that's a shockable rhythm. This is a rhythm that is the cause of the cardiac arrest could be because that we're in this weird rhythm and we're not going to get a pulse back until we fix that. All the CPR in the world isn't going to help this because what we need to do is reset the electricity in the heart first. So we shock that, we reset it, and then with good CPR, hopefully we turn on the SA nodes, we get a nice normal sinus rhythm, or maybe we turn on a different backup pacemaker that's a little bit more organized where we can actually beat our heart and survive.
And same with pulseless ventricular tachycardia.
Yeah, and so pulseless
it can be kind of more organized looking because it's constant, big, wide QRS complexes. So we know it's a ventricular tachycardia. It's going too fast, and it's coming from the ventricle because it's wide, but there's no pulse. So pulseless VTAC is another shockable rhythm.
And with pulseless VTAC, you can sort of think of it this way. If I were to resuscitate the heart and get it beating at this rate, this is such a fast rate that the heart isn't going to be able to pump any blood effectively, right? It's going too fast. So that's why we have to reset that as well.
Right.
All right, that is the EKG component of it, all right? So with ACLS, it's not just doing compressions and hooking up an AED and having it tell us if it's going to shock or not. Now what we're doing is we're looking at the EKGs ourselves and we're determining the need for shock and the need for certain medications. So we first recognize that someone needs cardiac arrest by they don't have a pulse. We begin doing CPR and we hook up an EKG to them. Through the pads, typically, we can look at these rhythms. If we identify a shockable rhythm, we're going to go ahead and shock it. So those shockable rhythms are VTAC and VFib with no pulse. If it's a non-shockable rhythm, then we just continue CPR. But every 2 minutes when we do our pulse check, we'll also check for a rhythm as well. We'll double check the rhythm and see if it has turned into a shockable rhythm or not.
And this is one thing where it's worth mentioning that high-quality advanced cardiac life support includes the basic stuff, right? But doing it at the best you possibly can. So like one of the things that really comes into play here is doing chest compressions while the AED is charging, right? So we're like, when we talk about this in BLS, but like you want to be off the chest for the most minimal amount of time possible. So the only times you should be off the chest is when an AED is asking you to be off the chest while it analyzes a rhythm. In advanced cardiac life support, though, you're the one looking at the EKG. You're not relying on an AED. So the only time you're off the chest is for less than 10 seconds to check for a pulse every 2 minutes and when a shock is being delivered. Any other period of time, you should be on the chest. So I get off the chest, we feel for a pulse, we don't feel a pulse, and I say, hey, this is VFib, we need to shock. I should get right back on the chest and do chest compressions until someone has dialed up the pads, is ready to deliver a shock, and then they're going to say off the chest, you're going to take your hands off, they're going to shock them, and you're going to get right back on.
And I think a lot of times with ACLS, people are like, well, this is basic EKG interpretation, and maybe I have some, maybe that could be an intimidating topic. It tends to be the most intimidating topic in ACLS is really just identifying EKGs. But people are like, well, I know tachycardia, I just count the waves and it's fast. Yeah, but you need to identify these rhythms in 10 seconds, right? Like, that's all we right. have. So we need to be able to identify the rhythm in 10 seconds and know whether we're shocking or not, or giving a medication or not. So that's the general CPR and shocking component of ACLS cardiac arrest algorithm, right? Now what we can do, too, is we can start adding medications in. So one medication that we're going to use is IV epinephrine, all right? Epinephrine is going to be used in pretty much all cases of cardiac arrest because epinephrine is a beta agonist that will hopefully get the heart beating. It's a chronotropic and it's an inotropic. It's going to get the heart to beat harder and faster. The more epinephrine we give, I shouldn't say it that way, but like we're giving epinephrine in order to get the heart to try to start beating on its own.
Okay? It's worth talking about here too, epinephrine. Currently, we do 1 milligram every 3 to 5 minutes. That is what the ACLS algorithm says for cardiac arrest. 1 milligram every 3 to 5 minutes. Why not 2? Why not 0.5? Why not every 2 minutes? Why not? There is actually no answer to that right now. There is actually a lot of research happening right now to say maybe higher doses. We used to do back in the 80s, much higher doses of epinephrine. We used to stack epinephrine doses and things like that. Then we went down to 1 milligram because research said maybe that would be better. And then it's a 3 to 5 minute range. But like, why not just 3? Why not just 5? These types of things. So I bring that up because it's important to know that these things can change. The algorithms do change. A lot of this stuff and the data we're using is the best data we have today, and that could change tomorrow.
And it might not be epinephrine.
Right.
It'll probably always be a big, you know, heart beta agonist, right? But it might not be epinephrine. For a while, we were using vasopressin.
Well, there's a lot of data to say that in people who get ROSC, maybe the epinephrine doesn't actually matter. Like, maybe we shouldn't be using epinephrine at all. Maybe we should. I mean, so again, like, we're using with the research and data we have today, we're using our best educated scientific knowledge, I guess, right?
Which is why, I mean, ACLS is typically a certification that you recertify every 2 years because the science, you know, does you know, the research changes and we get new information. Also understand that when you participate in a code, you're as much a part of the research as you are in part of the treatment, right? So like you are generating research, and once you do these reports and you fill that data out, that goes to organizations that use that as research to determine, okay, did we have good outcomes or could we have gotten better outcomes?
Another thing I'll say too with epinephrine. So epinephrine every 3 to 5 minutes, right? When we talk about high quality ACLS, and we're talking about minimizing, you know, time that we're off the chest and maximizing efficiency. If epinephrine is every 3 to 5 minutes and I'm doing pulse checks every 2 minutes, then my recommendation is epinephrine's every 4, because that means that every other pulse check, I'm giving a dose of epinephrine. So I'm getting off the chest. While I'm checking for a pulse, someone's pushing epinephrine. I'm reading that rhythm. I'm immediately back on the chest. I'm shocking or not shocking. I'm doing another 2 minutes of CPR, and then I'm off the chest again checking. And because what happens, I've seen this happen in codes where, you know, people are doing 3 minutes, people are doing 5 minutes. They're, you know, they're trying to like time it. Maybe they're off here or there. So we're giving epinephrine at random times. And then we give a dose of epinephrine, but then we don't know if we've got a pulse back. And then, well, do we need to circulate that epinephrine? All these questions arise. That just complicates it. Keep it efficient. You should be pushing epinephrine every other pulse check.
Right. And that's so simple. Everybody has something to do at the in part of your team. Let's say you got a 4-man team. You got someone who's on the chest. You got someone who's swapping off with someone on the chest. You got someone who's managing the IV, and you have someone who's managing the airway. That would be ideal, mm-hmm. right? At least those 4 people. So you've got... Everybody has something to do at that 2 minutes. The chest person switching with the other chest person and reading the rhythm and ready to activate the AED. The airway person is holding ventilations for a second so that we can check the EKG and make sure that we're good there and running the code. And then the IV person is pushing the meds that they've prepared in the 4 minutes that they've had to prepare those meds, right? So that's a big part of team dynamics, is a big part of ACLS and ensuring that you know this stuff, not just like perused it and understand it. You know this so intimately that you can operate in any aspect of that team, and you know that your team can as well. And you're able to do this under pressure and in, you know, seconds, not minutes. So another med that we may give in shockable rhythms is an antidysrhythmic. And this can be given right after epinephrine. It can be given with epinephrine. It can, you know, it's going to be given IV. And right now, the antidysrhythmic of choice in the field is amiodarone. Amiodarone, it acts as an antidysrhythmic. You can kind of think of it as a synthetic way of delivering a shock to the heart. It does the same thing. It helps get rid of those ventricular rhythms and encourages an environment for normal organized rhythms. So in our VTACs and our VFibs that are pulseless, we'll also be giving amiodarone. So you're not just checking that EKG and confirming that it is a shockable rhythm for the shock. You're also confirming if we're going to use an antidysrhythmic medication too. And we're talking about very basic codes. There are certain codes that you might need to do. For instance, you might see a special rhythm called torsades de pointes where you need to give mag sulfate and there's other. We're going to talk about sort of basic common codes in this one just because we can't cover every aspect of ACLS in a short period of time.
And that amiodarone, because we're doing electrical shocks to the heart, we don't really need that amiodarone immediately. We typically reserve that amiodarone for when we have what we call essentially shock resistant VFib or VTAC. So when we've shocked the heart a third time, and we still, that's when we push amiodarone in an ACLS algorithm. Mm-hmm. So we're not doing it with epinephrine immediately. Like we're doing epinephrine every other pulse check. We're shocking every pulse check if we need to. And if we get to a third pulse check and we are still seeing VFib or VTAC, we're going to push amiodarone then.
Yes, correct. And then the other part of advanced care that we haven't talked about too much is obviously you need to be able to get IV access to push these IV meds. You can also give them technically like interosseously if you have a bone drill and you need to drill into their bone because you can't get IV access. But you need to be able to get these medications. Some of these medications can be given down the tube too. But that's the other big component. This is airway management, right? So in a cardiac arrest, we want to have an advanced airway in place. Now, that could be intubation. That could be a supraglottic. That could be an LMA. But we want to have as advanced as we can get, as quickly and effectively as we can get, so that we can oxygenate the heart as well.
And without disrupting the other components of cardiac arrest. So we talk about this all the time. Like, we should not be holding chest compressions to put in an advanced airway, right? We should attempt if we can. But again, if we can't get one and you're like, oh, well, maybe if they weren't doing chest compressions, I could. Well, too bad. Chest compressions are more important.
Right. And we can, that might stop us from intubating, but you can put in an advanced airway that is supraglottic, like a King tube, a Combi tube, or an LMA. I mean, you can put those in without needing to visualize the cords and needing a laryngoscope. So if you can't get it after two tries, put a supraglottic in, right? Like we don't have time to kind of like mess with egos here or, you know, get the perfect. We're not always going to intubate. It's not necessary in that situation.
Yeah. And ideally, as I said, when we're talking about a super efficient, high quality, top of class, advanced cardiac left support, we want an advanced airway. Because once I have an advanced airway, now I can just breathe for the patient every 3 to 5 seconds, right? So I can just give them, I don't have to wait for breaks. If I don't have an advanced airway, then I have to be doing this 30-to-2 ratio, right? Which is what? Time off the chest. Every time we pause for two breaths is a pause in the chest. We want to be able to get to the point where we're just constantly doing chest compressions and bagging the patient at a normal, regular rate.
Right. And we talk about in our BLS lecture, you know, there's also gastric distension risk with basic airways with BVMs. There's a plethora of things, you know, that it's obviously a larger advantage to have an advanced airway in place with capnography attached in order to measure that. Yep. So, you want to talk about team dynamics quick?
Yeah, so we touched on it a little bit just a second ago, but the team dynamics is a critically important point. Now, I recognize that many of you work on the back of an ambulance with like two other guys, maybe one. You know, a lot of you work in ERs where you're understaffed and you don't have the... Ideally, though, when we talk about the highest quality, is there should be a team of six people for every code, right? There should be a team leader. That's usually the most advanced person there. I myself, as a physician, as an emergency physician, will typically take that team leader role. There should be someone doing chest compressions. There should be someone monitoring the airway. There should be somebody doing IV access and pushing medications. There should be somebody essentially managing the monitor, right? Nice. Delivering the shocks and that sort of thing. And there should be someone recording the event, all right? Ideally, we have six people there. There's actually a push now. I think ACLS recently redid their guidelines where they also have like a watcher now, someone who's like watching the chest compression person to like, so that the team leader doesn't have to focus on chest compression. That was new.
Yeah. I just kind of think that like at some point, like if you're like running the AED, you have nothing to do for 2 minutes at a time. Right. So you're watching the compressor and you're going to be the person that swaps with that compressor anyway.
Right.
You know
right.
I mean? So, or if you have a Lucas device in place or something like that, maybe you don't have a compressor cause you have a robot. So you're just managing that in the AED.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, exactly.
You can, from the paramedic side, you can run a code with two people. Ideally three,
right?
But you can run a code with two people.
Yeah, I think it's still like the highest quality efficient ones are calling for six people in this regard. A couple of things I'll talk about there. This is why clear communication is such an important part of advanced cardiac life support, is because I need to be able to articulate what my role is and understand what everybody else's role is as well. As a team leader, I used to encourage people all the time, I wouldn't even put on gloves if you're a team leader. Because what happens is as soon as I put on gloves and someone's having trouble with the IV or someone, you know, and we need a pulse check, I have a tendency to want to get involved and I immediately can lose sight of what my job is, which is to oversee the whole thing, right? So communicating roles really, really well, that kind of like back and forth communication. When I say push 1 milligram of epi, the nurse says back to me, all right, that's 1 milligram epi. You want me to push now? You know, like just in case there's mistakes. Yeah, the closed loop communication part is critically important.
Yeah.
Really quick, the Lucas device. So now we have these compressive devices that we can put on patients that do the chest compressions for us. I've seen a lot of people kind of snub their noses at them. The research shows that they're way better.
Yeah,
they are way better than us doing chest compressions. The other cool thing is that the monitor can read underneath the Lucas device most of the time. So, I can shock a Lucas device. So again, when we talk about time off the chest with a Lucas device, I might turn it off to read the rhythm, but I turn it right back on and I can deliver that shock while it's still going. And I should if I'm going to do that, right? I don't have to get off the chest to deliver the shock so I don't get shocked. The Lucas device can take the shock. It's perfectly fine. So like these Lucas devices are incredibly important augmentation pieces. They're expensive, which is part of the problem, but huge aspect to making sure that we're doing high quality chest compression throughout a code.
Absolutely. So one thing, last kind of part of a cardiac arrest code that we want to pay attention to is basically reversible causes. So like we're treating the cardiac arrest in the sense that we're trying to resuscitate, but there might be an underlying condition or something that caused this cardiac arrest that may have a common or quick fix that we can get to. And that's what these reversible causes are are designed to kind of help you with the 10 most common reversible causes of cardiac arrest so that we can also do kind of that adjunct treatment. Otherwise, what happens is we get so caught up in this rhythm of 2-minute codes that we never really think outside the box and start thinking, well, what could have caused this? Like, is there sugar low? Should I have just maybe given them sugar as well? And could that have helped? So we called the reversible causes the 5 H's and the 5 T's. And the H's are hypoxia. So if you have, you know, I'm going to say the cause, you tell me the solution.
Okay.
All right. Hypoxia.
Oxygen.
Give them oxygen, right? Hypovolemia.
Fluid resuscitation. So this is where fluid resuscitation could become an important part of your code. If you have, you know, a history or a reason to think that this person was extremely hypovolemic, or blood loss as well. Hypovolemia from blood loss. Well, now I need to be giving blood, a rapid blood transfusion at the same time I'm running a code. Because guess what? A heart that's pumping that doesn't have blood to pump is not really helping anybody, right?
Exactly. The hydrogen plus ion, right? So this would be acid. This refers to acidosis.
Right, so acidosis. So this is where we may consider things like sodium bicarb or, and even that, the research is really still out whether or not that's really beneficial in the code. But when we're looking at like truly reversible causes, I know this patient's supposed to be in dialysis. They missed dialysis for 3 weeks. Like maybe they're super acidotic. Okay, maybe I might push some sodium bicarb and that sort of thing.
And I think that's a perfect example of like, if I'm not trained to consider the H's and T's and that's not shoved into the algorithm, like you're, when you're running a code, you're not thinking about, oh, hey, did they get dialysis? You know what I mean? Right, like, right. Unless that's written in there, which is why this is really, really important aspect of the cardiac arrest algorithm, because it makes us think outside the box and get a little bit of a wider lens on the emergency. So next one would be hyper or hypothermia.
So maybe hypothermia in this case, but like there's this old adage that like you're not dead unless you're warm and dead. So if someone's like super hypothermic, like we need to warm them up as well, because that can obviously disrupt the electricity in the heart. That can disrupt just blood flow. Hyperthermia as well, though. I mean, someone's like, you know, like cooling them down with like cool fluids or bladder irrigation, ice packs to the armpits and groin and things like that. If they, you know, is also something to consider.
Yes. Hyperkalemia is the last H.
So hyperkalemia is, again, this is weird because it's kind of the same as the acidosis a little bit type of thing. So in hyperkalemia, though, if we want to, what's that?
You have
high potassium. So you may be considering giving things like
potassium.
What's that?
Potassium.
No, they have hyperkalemia. They have too much potassium, which causes like an acidotic type of thing. So
don't you just have to give them fluid to flush it out? Like,
give them fluid. I think you can do sodium bicarb again there too and stuff like that. But
okay. Typically, you'll see on the EKG, you'll see like peaked T waves if you have really concerning hyperkalemia.
Yeah, but
that one's, I would say, pretty rare. The T's, tamponade. So cardiac tamponade.
So cardiac tamponade is where you have blood in the pericardial sac pushing down on the heart. So if you think someone has cardiac tamponade because maybe you have an ultrasound at bedside or because of mechanism of injury with a trauma, a pericardial syntesis, you have to like literally stick a big long needle up through their xiphoid process to try to penetrate that pericardial sac and pull that fluid off the heart or around the heart.
And we cover cardiac tamponades in one of our other podcasts.
Do we?
Yeah.
No, cool.
Remember we did the whole weird like...
Oh, yeah, you're right. That was a good one.
Yeah. Okay. Tension pneumos. We definitely cover this in one of our podcasts. So
tension pneumothorax, collapsed lung, right? There's air. Just like there was blood outside of that pericardial sac and cardiac tamponade, tension pneumothorax, there's air trapped inside the chest wall cavity pushing the lungs down. Kind of goes back to hypoxia, right? I can give them oxygen, but the lungs collapse. It's not going to do anything. So I got to maybe put in like a... a chest tube to be able to pull that air off so that the lung can reinflate.
Or just pleural decompression if you're in the back of an ambulance and you don't have access to a chest tube.
Yep.
Then there's the two thromboses mm-hmm. that you could run into. So a coronary thrombosis, basically they had a heart attack.
Right.
Or a pulmonary thrombosis, they had a PE.
Right.
And
for both of these in the acute setting, we're going to potentially consider like alteplase. So you're going to consider essentially a clot-busting drug to try to break that clot up so that you can get flow again.
Yep. And then last T is toxins.
So toxins, so like overdoses, you know, like chemical, you know, chemical toxins, you know, medication toxins, overdose, an opiate overdose. Maybe they need Narcan. Maybe we're going to throw some Narcan in there to try to like reverse the opiate effects. I'm trying to think of other kind of like common toxins in that way. Carbon monoxide, you know, maybe we're going to do, you know, obviously oxygen therapy, but consider things like, or if you're worried about, you know, maybe like, what am I trying to think? Cyanide, things like that. Like we're starting to think about these things. Like, do I need methylene blue? Do I need like these different like random things to reverse, you know, different toxins as well?
Yeah. And that, I think that's an interesting point. Like take the instance of an opioid overdose, right? So they died from cardiac arrest. They died from cardiac arrest from respiratory depression. They died from cardiac arrest from respiratory depression from an opioid overdose. Right. Like it's bringing that chain back and saying, did they die from an overdose? Sure. But they ultimately die from cardiac arrest, understanding that chain. And then where can I interrupt that chain? Well, the CPR isn't resuscitating them. The oxygen doesn't seem to be resuscitating them. Oh, I can reverse these opioid receptors. Now they don't have respiratory depression. Now my treatments are helping. Mm-hmm, exactly. And it's thinking of that wider lens that's going to help us a lot. So that's great. That's cardiac arrest. Now we have like 5 minutes here to cover ROSC. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we bring them back. How do we know that we brought them back to life?
So two things. You either feel a pulse or you see a spike in your capnography reading.
Right. Only two things that will identify that someone is alive. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you either feel a pulse in your pulse check or you see a spike in their capnography. Hopefully then you can still confirm with a pulse check and feel their pulse. There is a chance that they're a larger individual, or if they have a very weak pulse rate, maybe you still can't palpate it. But that capnography and that pulse is the indicators that somebody is alive.
The first thing you then do is get a set of vitals.
Yeah, try to get a blood pressure on them.
Yeah, because there's four main things we're going to look at in return of spontaneous circulation, right? It's going to be their blood pressure, their oxygen status, their temperature, and then again, reassessing their cardiac electricity, okay? So the first thing we're going to look at is a set of vital signs. What's their blood? Do they have a stable blood pressure with this pulse? Maybe this is too weak of a pulse. They've got low blood pressure. What am I going to do about that? Maybe I'm going to give pressors. Maybe I'm going to give fluids, right? We need to start doing that. Right? Yeah, maybe they need to be paced because they're in a super bradycardic rhythm. So I need to, like I said, is their blood pressure stable? And if not, I need to treat that. I need to get that blood pressure up so I can oxygenate and perfuse the tissues, right?
We usually want to see something north of 90 systolic.
Yes.
If we can get north of 90 systolic and maintain that pressure, that's great. Like Chris said, what's causing that that hypotension, right? If it's bradycardia, then pacing. If it's an issue with contractility.
Hypovolemia fluids, right?
Yeah, if it's a contractility issue or just a pressure in general issue, I might consider, you know, like a catecholamine drip. That'd be your dopamine.
The next thing is going to be oxygen, right? We're going to titrate their oxygen from
93 is the like cutoff. So, right.
So 93
north of 99.
And I say 93 to 99, and here's why. If I oxygenate you at 100%, I don't know when you start to decompensate. So really quick, if I put you on a non-rebreather and you're at 100%, but you only needed 4 liters of oxygen, right? But I gave you a non-rebreather, you're at 100%. Now you all of a sudden need 6 liters of oxygen, but I've got you on a non-rebreather, so you're still 100%. Now you need 8 liters. But I've got you on a non-rebreather. Now all of a sudden you need a non-rebreather, but I already got you on a non-rebreather. Now you need more than a non-rebreather, and this is the first time I'm recognizing that you're decompensating. So the reason I tell people titrate from 93 to 99 is because if you can get someone down to 2 liters of oxygen and they're at 98%, but all of a sudden they're at 92% and you've got to titrate that up to 4 liters, 6 liters, you know that there's something going on and you're recognizing it earlier on.
So yeah, so those are kind of the two like vital signs that we want to manage, that we take the most concentration on when it comes to post-cardiac arrest care. The other two things that we want to pay attention to is we do want to run a 12-lead EKG. So if you go back to that picture where we saw just a view of the heart from that bottom right side, bottom right of our picture, where we're looking at an EKG, what a 12-lead EKG allows us to do is to look at, you know, 11 other angles, right? Mm-hmm. So we get a bunch of different angles of this heart, and that can tell us if there is blockage. And we'll talk a little bit more about this when we talk about like STEMI identification in ACS in part two. But this can tell us if there's blockage in the heart, if there's death of heart tissue. This can also tell us, are we sure about these rhythms?
Too fast? Are we too slow? Right. You know what I mean? Like that's where we get into the other algorithms with tachycardia and bradycardia.
So 12 leads, the idea behind that is more is better. Obviously, one view of the heart is great. If we can get 12 views of the heart, that's even better. So we can look at kind of different areas. And you can pinpoint different pathologies with a 12-lead EKG. So it's important to get a 12-lead post-cardiac arrest. And then we also are concerned basically about the metabolic strain on their body. So they have been dead. They've been in anaerobic metabolism without any oxygen. And that's going to create a lot of byproducts and toxins in their body. In order to remove those toxins, the best environment to remove those toxins and help the body repair and flush that out is a cold environment. So we will consider cooling the body between 32 and 36 degrees Celsius. And we'll do that with cold IV fluids. We'll do that with, I mean, what else do we, that's pretty much it, right?
Put big catheters in and can do, run cooling, that sort of thing. Cool, you know, they've got blanket things that like cool people down.
If we can cool that core temperature down, it basically slows the metabolic process and allows our body to be able to, and us to help kind of clean that body out of those toxins. Mm-hmm. And research has shown that we have better outcomes if we can cool. Yep. Now, there are some cases that cooling is not an ideal depending on the pathology of the cardiac arrest, like why they went down. But for the most part, cooling is an ideal situation.
And we usually tell you, like, consider temperature management, right? Like your hospital or your, you know, where you're taking the patient, if you're in EMS, like they're going to have temperature management like processes. So consider that and engage those right away to get that going if it's important.
Yeah. Like if you rescued me from drowning and then you did CPR on me and I cough up water and then I start talking to you and I'm like, oh my gosh, thank you so much for saving me. Don't like insert a cold catheter and cool my core temperature and put me into a coma.
Exactly.
All right. So that covers two of the six algorithms for ACLS. You can catch us in part two, where we're going to cover bradycardia, tachycardia, acute coronary syndromes, and acute ischemic strokes. They should be a little bit faster than this one. This was kind of the big intimidating one. So we are pretty much halfway there, even though we're only two out of six.
All right, cool.
We'll see you next time. Stay sweet.
Hey guys, thanks so much for taking a listen. If you are studying for the National Registry exam, we're here to help. We have a National Registry prep program to help you pass that exam. Check us out at guardiantestprep.com. If you'd like continuing education credits for listening to our podcast or watching this on YouTube, follow us at guardianceme.com. 100% free CAPSE credits. No matter what state or country you're in, we're here to help. So again, we thank you so much for listening. We hope you have a wonderful week.